You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we wish you the best for the new year.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. History happens when least expected, in a flash. On December 8th, after almost 25 years of rule, and against all odds, Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad was deposed by a small army of Islamist rebels. Assad, a reportedly soft-spoken ophthalmologist, has taken refuge in Moscow. Assad's ouster brings to an end 54 years of dynastic, authoritarian, and exceptionally brutal rule. Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, seized power in 1971. Memories of his crackdown on grassroots opponents affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood movement back in February 1982 still linger on. As many as 40,000 were massacred by Assad's military in the central Syrian town of Hama. Bashar the son may have been more easygoing than dad, but Syrians are reportedly very happy to see him go. As Assad's tyranny fades and the bodies of his opponents start to be dug up, reportedly in large numbers, far more powerful, arguably more brutal actors move in like wolves. The Turks, Russians, Saudis, French, British, and of course, the U.S. and its conjoined twin, Israel, are now turning Assad's downfall to maximum advantage. Israel, USA, and the Turks have been violating Syrian territory and airspace for years. The nation with the most at stake, as Syria's liberation is undermined, Palestine, has no leaders to stand up for its interests, all but annihilated in Gaza and wherever else its leaders now shelter themselves. The Islamic resistance movement, Hamas, no friend of Bashar al-Assad, has applauded the dictator's downfall. The ultimate outcome of Bashar al-Assad's downfall is anyone's guess. Everyone's got an informed hunch. One of them is Columbia University professor Jeffrey Sachs. Sachs is an economist and public policy analyst and the director of Columbia University's Center for Sustainable Development. He's the author of numerous books and articles about COVID, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Israel's war on the Palestinian people, and the unconscionable and incompetent state of U.S. public policy. Sachs's most recent writing focuses on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's grand strategy to depose regimes across the Middle East, North Africa, and wider Southwest Asia, a strategy well-received in the halls of neoliberal, permanently war-fighting power over in Washington. The GPM reached Jeffrey Sachs into New York City. My question, to begin with, was Bashar al-Assad's ouster engineered by Israel and the U.S., or was it the consequence of 53 years of tyrannical Assad family rule? Of course, two different explanations, not mutually exclusive. Your thoughts, please.
Well, fundamentally, this was an overthrow by the U.S. and Israel and Turkey, which had been working together to overthrow Assad for the last 13 years in a very direct way. The effort goes back even before that. The last phase of this, I think, caught everybody by surprise because it happened so quickly. But when one looks at what actually happened, Hezbollah, which is based mainly in Lebanon, had been a military backstop for the Assad regime. And Israel had pummeled Hezbollah in the past month in Lebanon. Hezbollah had pulled some of its forces from Syria to reinforce those who had been hit in Lebanon. Basically, Hezbollah was weakened, so was unable to provide military support to Assad. Iran could not reinforce or chose not to reinforce Hezbollah, and Israel was bombing the resupply routes. So, yes, this was a regime change operation in which Turkey, supporting the jihadist forces from the north. Israel and the United States all were apart. But it's important to understand this goes back a long time. This wasn't an event that suddenly came out of the blue, though the collapse seemingly came out of the blue. This is a war that the United States, for example, launched in 2011 under Obama, where Obama gave the orders to the CIA to work with Turkey and Saudi Arabia and others to overthrow Assad. And a major billion-dollar program called Operation Timber Sycamore was launched in 2012 to arm and finance jihadists to do exactly what happened last week. As usual in the United States, these events are not exactly publicized by the mainstream media. Operation Timber Sycamore was a classified operation until little bits and pieces leaked briefly in 2016, but little was known about it and little was talked about it. Our mainstream media are designed to hide this kind of programming from the public. The reporters are basically either directly working for the security state or they just source from the security state. And so we don't really ever learn from the mainstream media what actually is happening.
And you've written about this kind of coherent plan that was put forward back in the late 1990s by Benjamin Netanyahu to the U.S. administration, to those neoliberals proposing that all these regimes surrounding Israel from, you know, Iraq, beginning with Iraq and moving on to Libya and then Afghanistan, Sudan, and Lebanon, of course, and ultimately ending up with Syria. I guess the ultimate target is Iran, of course. Netanyahu was at the origin of this grand plan to depose all these various regimes in order to allow Israel to expand into its widest margins, you know, greater Israel.
Well, there is a strong symbiosis of the so-called neocons in the United States and Israel that goes back basically to the early 1990s. The neocons is the name for the group of U.S. foreign policy leaders who believe that it is the U.S. role to lead the world. Sometimes it's called being the world's hegemonic power, and that the U.S. should be the world's policeman. And this group is closely aligned with the Israel lobby, and especially personally with Benjamin Netanyahu, who became Israel's prime minister in 1996 and has been prime minister for 17 of the years since 1996. The neocons have a lot of arch-Zionists in them from the start. This is quite interesting. So it was from the very beginning a vision of American global role, which included a vision of Israel as being the American aircraft carrier in the Middle East, as it were, the beachhead for power throughout the Middle East. On the other direction, the Israel lobby has been very powerful in the United States going back to Harry Truman in 1948. And the Zionist lobby induced Truman on domestic political grounds to back Israel's independence in 1948. And the Israel lobby, which puts a lot of money into U.S. campaigns, both presidential and congressional, has had a firm grip on U.S. Policy vis-a-vis the Middle East basically for 70-plus years. But the symbiosis of the neoconservatism and the Israel lobby has been really something to behold. Back in 1996, a group led by Richard Perl, who is one of these neocons and also arch-Zionists and also senior U.S. foreign policy personnel in several administrations, produced a document for Netanyahu just coming in as prime minister called Clean Break. And the idea of Clean Break is to reject the idea of so-called land for peace. What this means is that back in 1967, when Israel conquered the Palestinian territories of East Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and Gaza, the idea immediately, from the point of view of international law, was that Israel would retreat from or leave those territories because they were occupied. They would not be permanently conquered territories. Israel would leave them, and there would be a peace agreement as part of Israel's departure from the occupied territories. So this is land for peace. As this evolved, the idea was that as Israel leaves the occupied territories, there would be an independent, sovereign state of Palestine alongside Israel, as had been envisioned in the 1947 UN partition plan. And this is what is in international law. Netanyahu and his political movement called Likud basically exists to block that. And the Clean Break was to try to end the talk of land for peace. And this is quite interesting. What Netanyahu said is, we're going to keep everything. We're never going to revert this territory. And we'll face opposition. We'll face movements like Hamas and Hezbollah. But we won't just fight those opposition movements. We will overthrow the states that support these opposition movements. It's kind of mind-boggling in its hubris. Of course, Israel by itself could never overthrow half the Middle East. The idea was that the United States would be Israel's servant in this. Israel would point out who to overthrow, and the United States would say, yes, sir, and go into battle. And this is actually how it's been. This is the combination of the Israel lobby and neoconservatism at play.
But getting back to Syria, the Syrian people and their resistance movements, of which there were many, have good reason, authentic reason, and authentic organic capacity to overthrow Assad on their own, surely supported and backed and encouraged by the United States and Israel, but fully in their power and capacity to overthrow Assad themselves, and with plenty of reason to do so.
Well, of course, they did not have the capacity to overthrow Assad. And some Syrians no doubt would have liked to, and others did not want to. But the capacity comes from armies. Armies are not wish lists. They're expensive. They require tanks. People have seen tanks. You don't just dream up a tank. You don't just dream up missiles and artillery and tanks and intelligence and training bases. These are billions of dollars operations. That's why wars are the actions of states. Wars are not the actions of civil movements and protest movements. Wars are the actions of states. And by the way, this is Netanyahu's own theory. And by the way, I completely despise Netanyahu. I think it's pretty obvious, but just to be clear about it. But Netanyahu said, look, we're not fighting Hamas and Hezbollah. They can't do anything unless they're backed by Syria, by Iran, by states. We're fighting states. In this, Netanyahu's right. What I despise about him is that Israel should compromise and pull back and have a Palestinian state. It's so arrogant and cruel to say, no, we keep everything. We rule over the Palestinians as an apartheid regime, or we ethnically cleanse them, or the Israelis say with their disgusting wink, we mow the grass, which means every few years we go in and kill a lot of people. It's absolutely repulsive. But that's Netanyahu's policy. But what he's right about is, yeah, he's fighting not Hezbollah and Hamas. He's fighting Iran or Syria or Iraq or other countries that are backing these opposition movements. The problem is the opposition movements are coming out of a real issue, which is that there should be a state of Palestine.
Jeffrey Sachs, what do you think is going to happen on January 20th and moving forward when Donald Trump comes into the White House? I'm wondering specifically, will Donald Trump green light Israel's complete cleansing of Gaza and its annexation of the West Bank? And I'm thinking, I have in mind this Recognizing Judea and Samaria Act that's now, I guess it's been put forward in the House of Representatives, mirroring Senate legislation brought forward by Tom Cotton, who's the incoming chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, basically calling on the United States to recognize, throw out the word West Bank and just refer it to Judea and Samaria, effectively acknowledging and endorsing complete annexation of Palestinian territories. What do you think Donald Trump's going to do? Do you think he's going to green light annexation of the West Bank and ethnic cleansing of Gaza?
I'm not so great at prediction, so let me describe where the situation lies and what I think we should do. First, almost all the world, other than Israel and the United States, agree that there should be a state of Palestine. This is in international law. It's in repeated UN Security Council resolutions. It's in repeated UN General Assembly resolutions. And it is in a recent judgment of July 2024 of the International Court of Justice, which says that Israel's occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, Golan Heights is illegal, and that Israel's border, from the point of view of international law, is that of the 4th of June, 1967. This idea of a two-state solution is basically universally held, but for Israel, which is ardently against it, and the United States. The U.S. vetoed Palestine's membership in the U.N. as the 194th U.N. member state at the beginning of 2024, when the vote was 12 in favor and the U.S. is the only opposed in the U.N. Security Council. So the U.S. is the backstop to Netanyahu. As I've said, basically, the Israel lobby runs U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, nothing less, or at least that's a shorthand way to say it, because anything Israel does, the U.S. says, that's fine. Anything Israel asks for, the U.S. says, of course, we'll do that. So you can describe it as Israel running the show, which it does. Now, if we actually went with the rest of the world and said, yes, there should be two states and that could lead to peace, we'd have peace. The Arabs have said clearly, unequivocally, since 2002, make peace, have a Palestine, and we will recognize Israel, have normal relations, and end the state of belligerency. I have spoken to senior diplomats all over the world about this, including all over the Middle East, all over West Asia, all through the Islamic world. They're ready for peace and normalization. It's Israel that isn't ready for or willing for any compromise, and it's the United States which is the handmaiden to this. Now, what will Trump do? I don't know, but if we simply extrapolate, yes, he'll say yes to whatever Israel says. He had very large Zionist financial backing in this election. That's true of all winning presidential candidates. Money talks in America. In fact, you sometimes wonder if anything other than money talks in America. But Trump is backed by big arch Zionist, I would say extremist Zionist money. Okay, so you would expect that he would go along with this. My only hope is that Trump is a kind of person who doesn't like to be characterized as doing someone else's bidding. Is Trump really going to make America great again when America is not even sovereign in its foreign policy, but is being used by Israel to do its dirty business? maybe Trump comes to understand this is absolutely not in U.S. interests. I think it's important to understand that we didn't get a chance to say this, but after 9/11, all of this became very specific with Netanyahu and the neocons laying out seven countries to overthrow. Seven, not just Syria, not just Iran. The list was Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, and Sudan. And damn if we didn't go to war with six out of seven of them.
And all of this is in profound violation of international law. Like looking at what Israel has done in Gaza over the last 14 months with U.S. bombs and missiles is in the most flagrant, profound breach of international humanitarian and human rights law, customary law, the laws of war. And Israel and the United States, I call them Israel USA, I see them as conjoined twins, have done this with complete and total impunity. And I think they've demonstrated to the world that international law is an empty shell. So my question to you, Professor Jeffrey Sachs, is what in your view is the connection between sustainable global development and the rule of law? What are the prospects, in your view, of confronting climate catastrophe, biosphere destruction, global plastic pollution, toxic pollution, in a world where international law counts for nothing?
It's a great question, because you might think, well, what's going on in the Middle East is one thing, but climate change is another thing. Sustainable development's another thing, and don't confuse them. But your question is right on target, because the United States government is a rogue state. It does not abide by international law, international standards, international respect. In fact, remember, Netanyahu now is an indicted war criminal. He's been indicted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity. What is the U.S. Attitude to that? Nothing. Oh, he'll be our best friend. Who cares? ICC, war crimes, crimes against humanity. Doesn't touch Tom Cotton, doesn't touch American political elites. Not at all. But, and it's so interesting, this is the same attitude towards the global climate crisis. This is the same attitude towards the sustainable development goals. This is the same attitude towards fighting global poverty. This is the same attitude towards protecting biodiversity. America's a rogue country. Look, America's not even a signatory to the Convention on Biological Diversity, because the U.S. Senate took the point of view already decades ago. Private property owners have the right to destroy any biodiversity they want. We're not going to let the UN interfere with the private property rights of big landowners in the United States. So they didn't even sign that. The United States, it's incredible, doesn't abide by the idea of sustainable development at all. This is a set of global goals, the SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, adopted in 2015. There are 193 UN member states. 188 have put forward plans to achieve the SDGs. 188. Five countries have not. Haiti, Myanmar, South Sudan, Yemen, and the United States of America. So every other country in the world has taken this seriously, not the United States. Why? Because the U.S. attitude is, we are the most powerful country. We're not going to be bound by anything. We do whatever we want, wherever we want, whenever we want. We can kill people. We can be complicit in genocide. We can do whatever we want. That's American foreign policy right now. Will it change under Trump? You got to hope so.
I mean, I'm kind of thinking with the president and co-president in chief, Elon Musk, probably he's going to get an office in the White House, and he's been tasked with promoting efficiency. But, you know, if Trump had his smarts about him, he'd task him with decarbonizing the American economy, because Elon Musk is the preeminent innovator in the world today. He wants to send humans to Mars. The guy could totally transform the United States' energy system. I'd reckon that he'd probably have a good chance of doing it as such an innovator.
That's correct. By the way, it's quite interesting because in a way, this is a tech-backed government, and a lot of America's top techies are actually in office or are supporting this administration. And they're not interested in endless war, World War III, destroying the world economy, and so forth. Maybe they'll have a constructive voice in all of this to say, you know, why don't we have peace, make a lot of money, introduce new technologies, and get on with problem solving. It's not impossible. I'm hoping. It's not how American politics has worked up until now, but it's not impossible.
Well, let me ask you a last question, Jeffrey Sachs. I'm wondering, in your view, what does competent leadership look like to you today? Who are the true leaders? And I look at somebody like Antony Blinken, who's now on his, 15th trip to the Middle East, and he's achieved nothing other than sending, you know, how many megatons of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere from his jet flights. He's a climate criminal, and he's achieved absolutely nothing, zero. So he and all these other folks around him seem to be complete incompetence. They're totally incompetent. You know, forget about their abidance with international law. They're incompetent. So my question is, what does competence mean to you today? And I guess an ancillary question is, it's a counterfactual one, that if Kamala Harris had won and she had asked you, tapped you to be her Secretary of State or National Security Advisor, what would you have advised her as a person who I figure is pretty competent? So there's a bunch of questions there. What does competence look like today?
Well, let me start with the last point. Kamala Harris never would have asked me to be Secretary of State because I have been absolutely against the Biden-Harris administration foreign policy. I think it's been absolutely in the wrong direction. And so that is a non-issue. Now, Biden, in my view, has been one of the worst presidents of modern American history. That's saying a lot because we have a lot of bad ones, and he's definitely been among the worst. His foreign policy has been especially egregious. His foreign policy team is, like you say, completely incompetent. They have just gotten us deeper and deeper into war all over the world. And I'm counting the days when they're gone because they've done an absolutely miserable job, and we need something different. What is competence? Well, when Elon Musk lands that rocket back in its holder, that is extraordinary competence. Now, that was the goal. He put to task world-leading engineers to solve that problem, and they achieved it. So that's competence. And competence means you set clear goals, and then you identify the path to success, and then you implement, and then you achieve your goals.
And they have to be ethical and moral goals.
Well, now, this is a point I was about to get to, which is landing that rocket in its holder is mind-boggling to me, and so I really applaud it. But when it comes to government, our goals are different. Our goals are peace, well-being of society, solutions for the world, addressing major, potentially catastrophic crises like the environmental crises, and so on. So part of the competence is actually choosing the right goals. This is what the ancient Greeks called phronesis, practical wisdom. In other words, it's not good enough to have instrumental wisdom to say, we're going to be more efficient at war. No, we need to start with the practice.